Hello and welcome to the APAC File, the joint bi-weekly podcast of Radio Free Radio Liberty and the Wilson Center focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the podcast here in Washington, D.C. The U.S. troops, along with the rest of the international military personnel, have slowly begun leaving Afghanistan, which, if continues as planned, all foreign troops will be out of the country by September 11. With that, the U.S.'s longest war ever fought on foreign soil will come to an end. Just stepping back for a minute, though, when the Biden administration announced this decision a couple of days ago, it has created passionate reactions both from inside and outside of the country. Taliban criticized it to be not soon enough. Some Americans, including President Biden's close allies, Afghans, and regional powers have criticized it to be too early. And everyone had a list of reasons behind their logic. Though it's been only a week since the start of the process, we thought, why not to take a look at how things have been going so far and what kind of implications are there to be seen at this stage? I guess the most important question going to be is, what are the scenarios for the country when all troops are gone, and where our eyes should be to determine as to what comes next and where things are headed from here? To discuss all these, I'm joined by Jonathan Schroden, director of CNA's Center for Stability and Development, Mariam Wardek, an Afghan-American journalist and director of HER Afghanistan, a women's rights NGO, Mustafa Sarwar, senior editor of Radio Free Radio Liberty's Afghanistan service, locally known as Radio Azadi, Michael Kuhlman, Asia Program Deputy Director and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us on this very important conversation. So let me start with you, Jonathan. It is finally happening and U.S. troops have started leaving Afghanistan. So what are some of your initial thoughts as to how it is going so far?
Sure. There's a couple of things that I think are interesting that are unfolding right now that are not entirely surprising. And so one of those is the U.S. military, I think contrary to what some people thought, but those who are familiar with the military, I think expected this, are moving out very, very quickly with the withdrawal. While President Biden gave, you know, a deadline of no later than September 11th to get all U.S. troops out of the country, what the U.S. military is effectively doing is a withdrawal to some extent under fire. And that is a very dangerous military operation. It's one of the most difficult types of military operations to undertake. And the longer the U.S. military takes to do that, the longer the window of vulnerability of U.S. forces in Afghanistan would be. And so I think what you're seeing is the military moving out in earnest to conduct that withdrawal. And so I fully expect that U.S. troops will be out of Afghanistan well before September 11th. And we could possibly see them out even by early July. There are some open source reports suggesting that the military may try to be out even as quickly as that.
So there was a discussion about that, Jonathan, like the U.S. might have reached an agreement with the Taliban, which would say that the U.S. troops might be out by July. So you are referring to that point, I guess.
Yes, that's right.
So was there any response by the U.S. authorities in terms of the authenticity of that reporting?
I have not seen anything publicly along those lines.
Okay. Yes, go ahead. You were trying to say something.
Just quickly, the second point I was going to make is we've seen some indications of, you know, Taliban fighters, some local areas, ramping up attacks as the U.S. withdraws. And in some ways, at a strategic level, that might be surprising in so much as some people may have expected the Taliban to stand back and kind of watch the U.S. go and not get in the way of that. But there are a lot of internal issues that the Taliban has to deal with respect to its own cohesion, the desires of local fighters to continue to engage, et cetera. And so it's, I think, not entirely surprising that the Taliban has moved to take advantage of opportunities in local areas where it sees the Afghan security forces as weak. And I think you're likely to see more of that as the withdrawal unfolds.
So, but Taliban, I think, as part of the agreement with the Trump administration, Taliban promised not to attack the departing U.S. military personnel. I think, at least the way I see it, they remain loyal to that commitment, I guess. They are attacking local Afghan security personnel, but still U.S. or international troops are kind of skipping their radar?
I think that's right, although I'll say the Taliban have kind of tried to walk a line on this point, right? They've had this narrative that if the U.S. wasn't completely gone by May 1st, that they would then be open season for attacks. And it's hard for them to walk that back with the U.S. not being completely gone by May 1st. But at the same time, right, they don't want to get in the way of the U.S. effectively handing them the withdrawal. And so the message that you saw from Taliban leadership was, you know, effectively, well, we haven't taken a decision at the strategic leader level as to what to do about that. But we leave it to local fighters, you know, and local commanders to decide what they need to do in their own area. That leaves open the window of some local commanders deciding, hey, I've got an opportunity to take a shot at an American airplane or something, and to actually do that.
There were a couple of rockets being fired at the Kandahar airport, I guess, a couple of days ago. But on the other note, though, Jonathan, you know, if things go smoothly as planned, all troops will be out, as you said, by September 11 or maybe earlier. So how should we visualize this? What's that you said? They are moving out very quickly. How should we visualize that mobilization from the military and kind of logistical perspective? What's actually happening on the ground as we speak?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. It's a very complicated process to withdraw under fire. And it would take a long time to describe it all in detail. So I'll just give some brief highlights. One thing that you will see is the collapse of the U.S. and NATO military presence from the 12 or 15 positions that it had, bases that it had, to a much smaller number of larger positions. You saw, for example, the closing of, or transfer, I should say, to the Afghan security forces of Camp Antonik, which was down in Helmand province, that there was a video of that posted on Twitter earlier this week. So they've already closed one of those positions. So you'll see that type of collapse of footprint down to several, two or three major locations, which will serve as the final hubs for withdrawal. And beyond that, what you're going to see is a lot of C-17, you know, cargo plane flights out of Afghanistan. There's going to be a lot of ground convoys of equipment that is not particularly sensitive in nature, going mostly through Pakistan to various ships to be shipped out. And you're going to see a lot of transfer of material to the Afghan security forces or the Afghan government, and frankly, a lot of destruction of material that the U.S. deems is not cost effective to ship back home, but is also too sensitive to hand to the Afghan government for any number of reasons.
Interesting. Okay, so Miriam, are you in Kabul these days?
I just returned 30 days ago.
Okay. So you are fresh from there. So it looks like, President Ghani is not in panic, but I remember worries being expressed both by friends and foes, even on this platform, people saying that as soon as foreign troops are out, the government of President Ghani is down. Is this thinking still relevant when you talk to people on the ground?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's an open secret that there is a concern when it comes to the government, especially the leadership. And I think that it wouldn't be wise, and he's upholding himself in the best political manner that should be, because when it comes to the ground reality of the people in Kabul, there is a huge scare. But I think that also comes to how
scared
the government
on what? Scared on what, Miriam? What they are saying?
What's going to happen? And this is only Kabul-centric. And I think this has a lot to do with the political influence, the fact that I think the government could have managed this very well, especially when the talks with the United States and the Taliban had initiated. But since it wasn't handled very well, and it seemed that the government and the delegation was constantly rejecting, moving forward, coming up with any sort of conclusions or reintegration mechanisms or even discussions with the public, Kabul is very resistant towards the Taliban returning. Right. But when you step outside of Kabul, if we go to Wardak, which is 50 miles out, it's already pretty much run by the Taliban. And then when you go to Kandahar, they're also in the provinces living in the way that it's already operated by the Taliban. So there is a huge acceptance that is in the air, but the resistance comes mainly from the cities who have political influence. Now, there are also discussions that I pose with my girls in her Afghanistan is that I don't think that you should be afraid in the sense that you're not the same public that the Taliban had dealt with in the 1990s. You're different. In the 90s, the people were submissive in the fact because they had the civil war, the Soviet invasion, and I think they were just exhausted of means, of finances, of emotions. So they just accepted in the sense, especially with the campaign that the Taliban had initially, was to bring the king back and they were going to bring peace. And then all of a sudden it turned into a different rule of law. But this time the public is educated. They understand freedom. They understand economic means. And many of them have a better life than they did before. So there will be a resistance. Whether that resistance will turn into a reason for another civil war will be determined. But the people who are educated don't want war and they prefer dialogue. And from the past few ceasefires that were taking place, the foot soldiers that had reintegrated into the city, they were also exhausted of fighting and they wanted peace because they wanted to come back and reintegrate themselves and live a more modern lifestyle than what they do live when they're outside of the city.
Yeah, we are going to look into the situation from that perspective in a minute. Staying with the military aspect, Mustafa, let me also bring you in here. Maybe I have two questions for you. One is, so what do you hear from Afghanistan? What is talk in town as we speak? And the second thing is, there has to be an impact of this withdrawal to Afghanistan, to Afghan military. You know, these troops were there for something, right? I mean, what kind of impact you are seeing military-wise on Afghanistan as foreign troops have just begun leaving?
Well, let me begin by the latest remarks by Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan's peace process, speaking to RFURL's Tajik service just recently. He said that if the Taliban are trying to take power by force, it won't be acceptable for the U.S. Any such government will be isolated. This comes at a time that the Taliban have escalated their attacks in different parts of Afghanistan. Just today, news came that the militants captured a key dam in southern Kandahar province. Also, just recently, local officials told us that they had to make a tactical retreat from the northern Burqa district in Baghlan, and you know, the key district filled to the Taliban. The Afghan forces are struggling to fend off Taliban offensives. So there are different analyses on the capabilities of the Afghan forces. You know, some would argue that the Afghan forces are well trained and they are able to fend off the Taliban attacks. But of course, there are major questions whether the Afghan troops are able to fight on the Taliban or to defend provincial capitals without any support from the U.S. Forces. You know that the U.S. is providing the bulk of the Afghan security and defense forces expenses annually, around $4 billion a year. So that's a huge question, that what will happen to that funding once the U.S. forces are withdrawn from Afghanistan.
Yeah, there was a talk about the funding. I mean, I think U.S. is committed to continue to provide some sort of funding for the country. Michael, I also wondered your thoughts on in terms of the two things here. One is like Taliban is certainly not happy by, although it's good news perhaps for them too, that the U.S. troops are finally withdrawing. But again, they were expecting this to happen way earlier, which has not happened. So they are not happy. They are perhaps they are angry. Maybe some of the attacks that we are seeing around the country, maybe that explains thinking around them. You know, we had a Taliban expert supposed to join us today. She could not, but in her absence, maybe you would like to jump in here on this question. The second thing is, Michael, so how do you see some of the immediate impact of the start of the withdrawal overall in the country?
To your question about the Taliban, I think that the Taliban is less likely to stage attacks on withdrawing U.S. forces now that it knows that there's a clear, specific date, which is pretty soon, when U.S. forces are leaving. You know, had the Biden administration announced that it was simply going to overstay the May 1st deadline with no clear indication of when it was going to go, then I think it would be much more likely that the Taliban would start or trying to stage operations attacks on U.S. forces after May 1st. So that suggests to me that the intensity of attacks on U.S. forces between now and September, or whenever all U.S. forces have left, will be much less than it would have been in another context. But indeed, I mean, you make an important point, and others have too, that the Taliban has been consistent and relentless and its messaging that, you know, it expects everyone, all U.S. troops, to be gone on May 1st. And the fact that they're not, even if they're heading out the door, may not be enough to keep the Taliban from hitting out. And indeed, as I think was mentioned, there was one case a few days ago when Taliban fired some rockets onto a base where U.S. forces were present in Kandahar, though it didn't cause any casualties or anything like that. I imagine that U.S. officials, Ambassador Khalilzad and others, are in close contact with the Taliban. I believe that Ambassador Khalilzad had met with Taliban leaders in Doha a few days ago, I think over the weekend. So clearly there's continued conversations between the U.S. side and the Taliban about trying to essentially impress this point upon them that the U.S. is still there now, but it's on its way out, and it will be out at the end of September, if not earlier. But, you know, one thing to consider and to keep in mind, indeed, we're hearing reports that U.S. airstrikes were launched against the Taliban in Helmand the other day, presumably in response to requests from ANSF, from Afghan security forces. You know, the possibility of the Taliban trying to use that as an attempt to retaliate against U.S. forces, that's problematic. And clearly the last thing that U.S. forces want when they're trying to get out is to find themselves at greater risk of getting hit. Obviously, it's not just good in terms of, you know, the threat to U.S. Soldiers and their lives, but also the optics. You know, the Biden administration wants to minimize this idea of U.S. forces withdrawing under fire, even though that could happen. And then finally, just some broader points. I think there's several interesting questions to consider here. We know that the withdrawal is now underway, but still a lot of questions that haven't been addressed. And one is, who really is leaving, right? I mean, the official line is that everyone is leaving. But there's some reasonable questions about what becomes of all of these contractors that are still there, intelligence operatives. You know, a number of contractors, as I understand it, have contracts that run well beyond May 1st or September 11th of this year. So what happens to them? That's stuff that remains to be seen and sensitive. And this is not the type of thing that U.S. officials would speak about openly and publicly, but that's important. And finally, the issue of messaging, I think, is critical. U.S. government messaging to the Afghan government and the Afghan people. The U.S. is on its way out. Even as the Taliban ramps up offensives against Afghan security forces and invariably civilian casualties come out of that, how do you convey to the Afghan government and the Afghan people more broadly that, you know, this is not an abandonment? I mean, it is an abandonment, but how do you convey this idea that other aspects of U.S. assistance will continue, certainly the financial assistance, diplomatic engagement on a peace process? I think that messaging element is really important and will be should be a key priority for the U.S. government.
Michael, do you see that kind of efforts going on at the moment as you speak, like, you know, trying to convey a message to Afghanistan that this is not the repetition of what happened in the past? Do you see any effort like that?
Well, I mean, we had several senior U.S. officials in Afghanistan in recent days, and I believe that message was conveyed for sure. But I think that it's been conveyed more toward the government, not in the sense of public diplomacy. I haven't seen any targeted attempts to sort of promote this idea to the Afghan public on the whole, which, of course, as was noted by Mariam before, there's a lot of nuance there. There are a number of Afghans that are perfectly happy to see U.S. forces leave. So that's not the part of the audience that you want to get through to. But I do think that the public diplomacy aspect of this is important too.
So from the receiving end, Mariam, how do you see this public diplomacy aspect that Michael is raising from the perspective of the United States explaining the reason why they are leaving and how they are leaving?
Well, I think that it was totally mismanaged in my perspective. The fact that it started with President Trump stating that we are not to be policing other people's country, which is accurate, but how it came off was extremely insulting. The fact that it's been over 11 years since they found Osama bin Laden, and now they're saying that they've completed their task, but not really attending to taking responsibility and acknowledging that they've made a mistake, acknowledging that they found Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. They keep refraining these kind of information, which kind of belittles all the Afghans and the sacrifices that Afghans have made in this war against terrorism. And the fact that they're not talking about the fight of terrorism, and they need to be very realistic that it's not over, and terrorism is a very relevant and there. And we have 22 other active terrorist groups in Afghanistan, and how those will be managed. I mean, those types of messagings are not there, and it's insulting and very belittling and insensitive. Mm-hmm. And I'm also not, you know, when Zalmay Khalilzad holding these interviews, of course, one of the things that we have to be extremely clear on, this is where the mixed messaging comes from, right? So Zalmay Khalilzad is an Afghan-born American citizen working for the U.S. government. But when he comes to Afghanistan, this is probably one of the, you know, best appointments President Trump had made, because he speaks the language of the people. So the people believe that he's looking at their best interests. But in reality, he's executing the U.S. interests. And I think this is where the Afghan government should learn something from the U.S. government. When it comes to sending a delegation to speak to the Taliban, you send individuals who speak their language and that they feel comfortable with, just like how the U.S. government had sent Zalmay Khalilzad. Right. Now, when you speak to Zalmay Khalilzad, he pretty much paints a very rosy picture and talks about how the U.S. will still look out for the Afghan interests, and X, Y, and Z will not happen, and we won't allow anything happen to women or the human rights aspect. Mm-hmm. But in reality, when it does happen and there's nobody on the ground here, how will they manage it? Are they going to invade Afghanistan again? So this is not right, especially what's happened post-Soviet, when the U.S. pretty much dropped Afghans after the dismantle of the Soviet occupation. These can bring back negative feelings, and the Afghans are allies to the United States and other European and foreign countries, and we would like to be treated as one. And this is where the sensitivity comes. This is where emotions are very prevalent, and they will determine the course of future actions of others. So we need to manage this very carefully.
Jonathan, if you are still with us, Michael just raised one quick question, which I wanted to bring up. So Michael was talking about, when we say, you know, international military personnel are leaving Afghanistan, who do we really have in mind? Who are leaving? Who are staying behind? Any insiders to this question? I mean, what should we really understand when they say we are leaving? Who they mean?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And I mean, the terminology in the U.S. Taliban agreement is quite clear that the U.S. committed to the withdrawal of all non-diplomatic U.S. personnel. And listed there include uniformed troops, contractors. I believe it also says intelligence personnel. So it's quite clear in the Taliban agreement what the U.S. has committed to withdraw. Now, what constitutes diplomatic personnel? I mean, there is some wiggle room there in terms of what that entails, right? I mean, that effectively refers to a U.S. embassy presence, but the U.S. typically has Marines on the ground to secure its embassies around the world. In countries where the U.S. provides large amounts of security assistance, which it has pledged to continue to do in Afghanistan, there's usually a security cooperation office inside the embassy, which includes some number of uniformed personnel. So the idea that the U.S. will go to literally zero uniformed personnel in Afghanistan, I don't think is either the U.S.'s intent, nor do I think that's entirely consistent with the terms of the U.S. Taliban agreement. Whether the Taliban understand that is a question I haven't been able to resolve, and we'll sort of see how they respond. But that's how it looks to me. NATO personnel will also go, NATO uniformed military personnel. Each of the NATO countries will have to decide what it wants to do with its embassy presence, similar to how the U.S. is trying to decide. And then beyond that, there's the question of how does the U.S. continue to try and protect its interests in Afghanistan without having a large-scale military presence there? And that is something that the Pentagon doesn't seem to yet have figured out. I mean, the the commander of U.S. Central Command, General McKenzie, testified in front of Congress last week, was asked this question. He kind of demurred and said, you know, we're looking at a number of other basing options in the region, which some have speculated, you know, might include U.S. bases in the Gulf or U.S. naval assets in the Indian Ocean or possibly even a U.S. base in one of the Central Asian states. And he also mentioned the possibility of remote advising, which is something that I and one of my colleagues at CNA have written about. The idea that you could continue to provide advice and support, you know, knowledge transfer type support to the Afghan security forces, you know, through Zoom effectively or through other, you know, digital communication means like WhatsApp and direct messaging and email, et cetera. And so it's clear the U.S. is exploring a lot of different options for how to continue to stay engaged with Afghanistan without having the military be there in large part.
Right. So still we have a couple of months to go before these withdrawals are complete. So what's next? What are some of the milestones until September 11? And how should we imagine Afghanistan beyond September 11? And what are the areas we should keep our eyes on to determine where things are headed from here? Let's continue the debate talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the discussion that today on the APAC File podcast, I'm joined by Jonathan Schroden, director of CNA's Center for Stability and Development, Maria Mordek, an Afghan-American journalist and director of Her Afghanistan, Mustafa Server, senior editor of Radio Free Pretty Liberty's Afghan service, Radio Azadi, Michael Kugelman, Asia Program Deputy Director and senior associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Pretty Liberty's media manager and host of the APAC File podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the early days of withdrawal of Western troops from Afghanistan. So maybe, Michael, we can start with you. Now that the withdrawal has formally begun and it is sort of unclear whether there will be a deal by September when the withdrawal will be complete as it stands. And what if there is no peace deal? So there are so many questions and Taliban remains ambiguous and their future rule remain ambiguous. So where are we really going from here on the political front?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, my view is that the Taliban won't be willing to cooperate much at all in negotiations until all U.S. troops have gone, or until it's told that all U.S. troops have gone, just because of its repeated messaging and, you know, the fact that it pulled out of this Turkey conference that was supposed to have happened late last month. It said that it wouldn't participate in any conference related to Afghanistan so long as U.S. troops are still there. You know, that indicates that it really is not interested in committing. Now, certainly, it's continued to have its discussions with diplomats. You know, the Taliban has been meeting with a number of dignitaries. I think that met with some EU officials not too long ago. So those discussions are happening. But in terms of its commitment to getting back to the table to talk with the Afghan state, the Afghan government, I don't think we can expect much on that. Mm-hmm. But the other issue here is, you know, the situation with President Ghani. I mean, this is someone who had been under a lot of pressure from his rivals at home, but also from the U.S. to do things in service of a peace process that he was not comfortable with doing because they could have led to him having to step down from power. You know, he published an article in Foreign Affairs magazine the other day in which he articulated what I believe he probably would have wanted or would have articulated at the Turkey conference, in which he laid out a vision for a peace process and a peace plan. It highlighted the need to do things like having elections soon, having an immediate ceasefire that I think the Taliban would not be interested in entertaining, and certainly not while U.S. troops are still in the country. So a lot of question marks about where the peace process is going. I think for the U.S. government, the main goal is to just try to ensure engagement with the Taliban up, keep conversations going with the Taliban to ensure at the very least that it remains committed to a peace process, even if it's deferred. And I imagine that issues about reducing violence continue to be a major talking point and agenda point for the U.S. side and others as well. But again, it'll be very hard to get the Taliban to yes on any of these issues related to the peace process, so long as troops are still there. And, of course, once all troops have left, that gives the Taliban a new incentive to basically focus on the fight altogether, even that it'll have a major advantage.
That's the area where I'm thinking about, Michael. I mean, what if once troops are gone, or at least minimize the number, then Taliban just simply say, no, we just keep fighting unless our demands are met. Then what can be done about that?
Right. I mean, this is the big question. It comes down to the issue of how important is it for the Taliban, or how willing is it to gain a share of power through negotiations, as opposed to just trying to seize power by force. And this gets to the issue of legitimacy. I think this is the one thing that the U.S. and others hold on to, this idea that, you know, you got to like emphasize this point to the Taliban. If it wants to continue to enjoy the legitimacy and the recognition that it seems to have from the international community now, it needs to remain committed to a peace process. And if it rejected peace, and if it's just focused on the fight and sought to seize power by force, mm-hmm. it would become a pariah again. It would no longer be seen as legitimate. It wouldn't get foreign assistance and so on. It's a fair point, but that begs the question of how important is that issue of legitimacy to the Taliban? Yeah. I think it is important, but does it need to have that to achieve some of its goals, especially its military goals? Well, not necessarily.
Hmm. Well, you know,
if I may, I just want to add a point to Michael's remarks. Major question that what will happen if there is no peace at all. We have seen some activities by some former jihadi figures, such as Ismail Khan, for example. They have said that if there is no peace, they will mobilize their supporters and defend their territories or their provinces. You know, some talk about the possibility of a civil war, but President Ghani has repeatedly said that his government will not fall. The Afghan Ministry of Defense has also said that the Afghan forces will be able to defend the people against Taliban attacks. But many questions remain unanswered as to what will happen to, as I mentioned before, the funding of the Afghan forces after the withdrawal of the U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Another big question is whether the Afghan forces are able to defend all provinces without U.S. air support.
You know, even though, just to follow up on what you are saying, Mustafa, maybe we can switch to Mariam to take her point on that. So even though if the Afghan government, the President Ghani's government doesn't fall, even though the Afghan forces are able to, you know, defend the country as much as it can, you know, the fighting certainly means a bloodshed. Alternative to that is, okay, if that's not what we are looking at, we need to accommodate Taliban in some way or form or shape that they join the government. Now, looking into this, Mariam, you know, Afghans in the Taliban vision of the future government is very different. So when the troops are gone and Taliban stick to their own vision of the future, then what? How Afghans see that possibility kind of playing out going forward?
So again, you have three different populations to look from. So you have the government population that is very dependent on donors and want international presence because of the way they operate and how they benefit from the current status quo. Then you have the individuals who live in cities, the citizens who live in cities and benefit from international presence. And then you have the provincial people. So the provincial people who are already living in some sort of co-government mechanism where you have the Taliban shadow governor, Taliban commander, etc., they will assimilate quite easily. Now, in Kabul, the concerns that are raised is whether girls will be able to attend to work is a concern. Second is whether they will have to have a chaperone, an Islamic chaperone with them. Third will be whether how will they dress. I think dressing is such a superficial conversation, and it kind of took me by surprise when I heard many of these topics at discussions, because that should not matter at all. And it is only relevant to Kabul, per se, because most of the provinces are still strongly conservative in their dress codes, whether it's Herat, whether it's Jalalabad, whether it's Mazar. So that was a little shock. But when it comes to being able to work, because many of the females are matriarchs in their private homes, where they've lost their brother, father, husband to the current war on terror, and they have to bring the financial means. Then you have the kind of violence that they will portray on what type of structure will be there. I am extremely proud of our Afghan National Defense Security Forces and how they have upheld, you know, the morale of the soldiers. But again, is one of the concerns I have is how are these individuals who are fighting going to then stop fighting with these people that they have been at war with for 20 years? Yeah. That's a huge psychological toll that will take on the Afghan National Defense Security Forces? And what are the repercussions of this? Will some of them take arms, like your colleague had mentioned? I know that they're political figures who are ramping up arms and being prepared in case things go down. But there's also a psychological twist that can take place, and there could be random assassinations or shootings that can happen and that we should be also prepared for, that we have not attended to. And then also the commitment, I think how all of this will transform is to the financial commitment by our foreign allies to Afghanistan. Will be able to manage all of this very well, because I think the Afghan Taliban want to work with international allies and bring some sort of prosperity and stability to Afghanistan, and so does the Afghan government. Now, another aspect that we should look at it is peace is not on the table. We need to stop even thinking about it as a peace process. We need to look at it as a stability angle, because there are going to be people who are going to violate the ceasefire. What are going to be the mechanisms of those violations? How will the international allies with the Afghan, whoever is the structure, handle those violations? So there's so many questions that are unanswered, and we are leaving the public blind. So the government needs to directly communicate with the public and explain to them what's happening, because the fear of the government is felt by the people, and it is an open secret. So they don't want to talk about it on record, but they're talking about it privately. So, and I think that's unfair and uneasy.
Right. Wow.
I just want to add a point that might be interesting. We have spoken to a wide range of people in different parts of Afghanistan, not only Kabul, for example, in Herat, Nangarhar, Balkh, Bamiyan, and Kandahar. And we are talking with them on a daily basis, such as female athletes, teachers, peasants, students, and other ordinary Afghans. Many of them that we have interviewed so far, they say that their achievements over the past 20 years should not be stepped upon. Many of them call on the international community not to leave them alone as it did back in the 90s. So perhaps some of the remarks made by some U.S. officials are somehow promising. For example, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that the United States will not leave Afghanistan alone. And Khalilzad has also told us in an interview that the United States wants to have strong relations with Afghanistan. NATO has previously said that it would fund Afghan forces until 2024. So these remarks might be somehow promising to the Afghans. They have fear for their future.
If I may, can I say one more thing? Sorry.
Yeah.
One of the things that does bring me a concern is this narrative of we don't want to take back the strides that we have made. I want the listeners to understand that these strides are not in all of the provinces in Afghanistan. Most of these strides are city central, especially when it comes to athletes and women being able to mobilize for their work very freely. It's in international organizations. It's a very small percentage of the population. And we have to be very careful of the kind of image that we are portraying to the public, because people in Wardak, even in Kandahar, no female is allowed outside of her home without a male chaperone. And if she is, it's because the driver is either with them, the parents know where they are, and it has to be during daylight hours. And in Kandahar, they completely wear a burqa, or they wear a black abaya covering their face and just showing their eyes. So the country, it is a conservative country. The jeans look and the girls being able to go out past 7 o'clock is only Kabul-centric. And the kind of strides that they've made from the 1990s, I mean, one thing that we have to understand on what happened in the 90s is that the civil war really took a psychological, mental, emotional, physical toll on the people, where our own people were committing the atrocities. So we have to also be very cognizant of the aspect that a negotiation is a compromise from both aspects. I don't want the Afghan people thinking that the Taliban need to do X, Y, and Z, and we need to keep what we have. And that the individuals that are saying we need to keep what we have is that small percentage, which is, I think, is not going to be beneficial for the greater good. There needs to be compromises on both aspects. And this is where communication comes. And this is why I feel like the delegation that's in Doha needs to be relooked at. And we need to start having Islamic scholars hold these negotiations, because the one thing that both agree on, that it needs to be an Islamic form of government, whether it's going to be an emirate or a republic, that's the discussion that needs to take place.
Let's see if that negotiation continues going forward. I mean, it's now, it looks like halted, and Turkey conference that they were planning on is also in question at the moment. Also, let's try to conclude the discussion here. You know, I know there are so many questions that we might be skipping today, but the reality is that things are complicated in whatever direction you are looking at into this. But at the same time, it's a new beginning that foreign troops are finally leaving, and they will be gone soon, maybe earlier than September 11th. Now, this kind of presents a new reality that we all need to cope with, so in so many levels. It also brings lots of uncertainty. I guess we have to wait and see as to what comes next, but where our eyes should be to determine at what direction things are headed from here. Michael, maybe you would like to jump in here. I know we are kind of skipping as many questions, including, you know, this is your area, Michael, including views from the region. Speaking of the region, next week on May 13th, we are planning a conversation at the Atlantic Council on the Russian and Iranian perspective on the Afghan peace process. We hope to unpack some of these questions there. But in general, today in our conversation, we skipped the regional view. So maybe here we would like to take your perspective on the views from one of the most important stakeholders in whatever happens in Afghanistan going forward. That's Pakistan's perspective on all these matters. So where they stand on this, and also your thoughts on what you will be looking at as Afghanistan entering to this new crucial period.
Yeah, so I think that not just Pakistan, but really the whole region, Afghanistan's immediate neighbors and other in the region, they're all concerned about the potential spillover effects of destabilized Afghanistan that's quite likely once the U.S. has completed its withdrawal. You know, I think that's quite clear, whether you're talking about refugee flows or drug trade, cross-border terrorism, that type of thing. And, you know, Pakistan, it's always been a bit of a mystery as to what it really wants in Pakistan and Afghanistan post-U.S. withdrawal. Mm-hmm. You know, some would argue that they're one of the few actors that would actually benefit from a withdrawal of U.S. forces, and that will just make the Taliban stronger, the Taliban being a key asset, proxy, whatever term you want to use, that, you know, that would essentially, a stronger Taliban that comes about from a departed U.S. would benefit Pakistan, because it would make it even easier for it to retain access and leverage in the country. But you know what? I think Pakistan, you know, the deep state, you know, you get to the intelligence agencies, the military, what their worst case scenario is also everyone else's worst case scenario. And that's the situation where the Taliban essentially just keeps fighting and eventually takes over the whole country. I don't think Pakistan wants that, because it would worry about the impact that could have on empowering and emboldening terrorists inside Pakistan, including you know, the Pakistani Taliban, which is based in Afghanistan but has been carrying out an increasing number of attacks in Pakistan as it makes a comeback. And those two Talibans, they don't have an alliance or anything like that, but they are ideological, spiritual allies. So I think Pakistan, like others, would like to see some semblance of a peace process be retained, though I agree with what's already been stated that it's perhaps not unrealistic to even refer to it as something like that at this point. Bottom line is, I think that the region generally sees eye to eye on very basic macro levels for wanting there to be more stability, but they differ on the ways to get to that modicum of stability. And I don't think it's realistic to think that, contrary to what the U.S. government says, that there could be some type of regional peace mechanism or regional consensus that's developed. So just because these countries, they operate across purposes, they support different factions, different armed groups in Afghanistan, and it's going to be very difficult to assume that there could be any type of regional outlook. Final point in terms of where I'm looking, how long does the U.S. remain engaged diplomatically, and how long does it continue to provide financial support? It wants to do both. Mm-hmm. I think the latter will be diminished, but how long is it willing to stay engaged financially and diplomatically once U.S. forces have left and as the situation continues to get worse? I think that's a key thing to look at.
I think last week I heard that the U.S. embassy has decided to shrink the diplomatic presence there. I don't know by what number, but there was a news. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is for non-essential staff to leave. It's unclear how many and for how long, but indeed, I think that was a security measure. But the embassy is still quite well populated and will continue to be so. But I think that was a step taken in anticipation of the violence that could ensue as U.S. forces are on their way out.
Okay. So final thoughts from both Maryam and Mustafa from you guys. So as we speak, where we are at the moment in terms of those developments, both militarily and politically. So what comes next after this and where your eyes will be to determine where things are headed going forward from here? Let's start with Mustafa and Maryam.
Various scenarios arise. For example, that some neighboring countries that were previously involved in the Afghan civil war in the 90s may once again support their proxy forces in Afghanistan after the withdrawal of the international troops from the country. Some say that no country in the region wants a civil war in Afghanistan. For example, again, Khalilzad said that Pakistani leaders understood that the civil war in Afghanistan would have catastrophic consequences for their country. And many countries in the region have already called for a responsible withdrawal of the U.S. troops from the country. So I think that if the U.S. Stays engaged, if the U.S. is not going to leave Afghanistan alone this time around, and if there is some sort of a political settlement, there is still hope at the end of the tunnel, as they say, and there is some opportunity for Afghanistan and for the region.
Okay. Yeah, I see Mustafa trying to be optimistic here. Maryam, your thoughts on what comes next and where your eyes will be, you know, going forward?
I think I'm going to focus a lot on communicating with the public and understanding the current dynamic, the discussion plays. One angle that I have started to see is this disappointment and this emotional appeal to the world community of leaving Afghans behind, which is quite disheartening that we, the Afghan people, would think that, and that we need to understand to take responsibilities in our own hand and to talk to our own people. International allies should not be meddling in internal affairs. I am hoping that the number of Afghans will reduce the killings, whether it's civilians, Afghan Taliban, or the Afghan National Defense Security Forces, because no matter what, it's Afghan people dying, and it's pretty much a massacre on a daily basis. So I will follow all of this very carefully, but more so to build the knowledge of women to be able to communicate on what matters important. So basic healthcare, access to education, access to employment is what are the three important issues for them.
Right. These things are, you know, topic for a discussion if and when those intra-Afghan dialogue to start at some point in the future. But let's see. Let's hope. With this, we need to end the conversation here today. Thank you very much, Maryam Wardak, an Afghan-American journalist and the director of Her Afghanistan. Also, big thanks goes to Jonathan Schroden, director of CNA's Center for Stability and Development, Mustafa Server, Senior Editor of Radio Free Liberties, Afghan Service Radio Azadi, Michael Kugelman, Asia Program Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Again, thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today and for your time in TAS. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Liberties Media Manager and host of the AFPAC File, a joint podcast series of Radio Free Liberty and the Wilson Center. Please join us in 2 weeks. Until then, bye-bye.